Welcome back to another episode of the Fusilade, an Arsenal podcast by the Short Fuse. Again, with me today, I have Vic Akers and Aiden Gibson. Gentlemen, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Travis. I'm really excited about our switch to becoming the interwebs number one Rihanna fan club podcast, sponsored by Empress 1908 Gin. Guys, go ahead and send that bottle over. Big fan. I think we had a deal because you retweeted my tweet. So first sponsor of the pod, I think.
I'll work with that as long as you get your drunk on. I'm fine with that.
It's Rihanna FC, not Arsenal FC. Hashtag 2018, not 1886.
Correct. You are 100% accurate. In fact, I think the next program is going to have that printed right on that. So, yeah. Kudos to the Arsenal for finding out that Rihanna still likes her German national footballers.
There's our intro music for the week.
Yeah, you know, I think it was Mustafi who retweeted. Of course, he was on Twitter. Had to start off with back on top, no matter what. But I think he had the hashtag work, work, work. So I think that should probably be the intro music.
Well, I think back on top is actually Rihanna's next single. Maybe Mustafi can get in on that.
What an outstanding reference to the exploits of Olivier Giroud.
Yes, we do want to save the Giroud here for a little bit. Yeah, that because, you know, I want to be able to...
That's what Giroud says when he hires a prostitute.
You
that
know...
That was for you.
You've got to let your money... You got to get your money's worth. Got to make it last. So that's, that's totally fair of Ollie.
Well, and now that he's, you know, still staying in London, I'm sure that there's going to be more exploits to come, right? So he didn't go off to like Sevilla or Dortmund or what was the other club that was rumored with him that he mentioned? Roma might have been dangerous for Giroud. That he could have had a lot of fun there, I think. But you know, staying in London, I don't really think the I really don't think that the real Giroud is ever going to be leaving.
No. Certainly not.
No. So, just kind of want to have a nice, easy discussion here about the match. It's actually really refreshing to be talking once again about an Arsenal home match where they score four goals in like 20 minutes. But clearly something was different, and that was Henrik Mkhitaryan and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang making their home debuts and or club debut. And you know, I don't know about you guys, but that first goal, and I mentioned this to Joe earlier, Joe 3K on a Facebook Live video. I mentioned it to him that it really felt like the way that Henrik Mkhitaryan moved within space and the understanding of when the passes were going to arrive and where to knock it onto with a Ramsey basically occupying that space that Aubameyang left for a goal that was clearly ahead of whatever the defense was expecting. You know, I know that they played for 20-some minutes in Swansea, but this is his first full match, and it looked like they've been playing together for years. And it was beautiful. It was one of the best goals that I think that we've scored, a team goal, in a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, so there's sort of, I think, two points to that, which is one, you kind of, I think Ian Wright was on AskCast last week and said that, you know, he'd been told that Mkhitaryan had been, quote, absolutely flying in training. So, you know, I imagine that that plays a role. Yes, he'd only played 20 minutes of game time, but I mean, you know, sort of training, you kind of can develop relationships with players. I think secondly, you know, intelligent football players, and you know, it doesn't take long to see that Henrik Mkhitaryan is a very intelligent football player. They're always, I think, going to be able to play well with other intelligent football players, of which you've got prime example Mesut Ozil. And so I think that kind of played, that was sort of a key role. And obviously, you know, and we've mentioned this previously, but when you bringing in Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang, the kind of idea behind that is you bring in two players who already have a really good understanding because they'd played so many times together beforehand. And obviously Mkhitaryan set up Aubameyang's goal. Obviously Aubameyang set up Mkhitaryan's cross for Aaron Ramsey's first. So, you know, I think kind of there's sort of two things going on here. One is, you know, the developing relationship between sort of the Arsenal players and namely Mesut Ozil with these new players. And secondly, kind of the relationship that they already had in. But I think, you know, the kind of the thing that was very apparent and we can get into this more, but I think that was very apparent yesterday watching the game, is that this is now a team that's built around our new £350,000 a week man, Mesut Ozil. And you know, this is a team where he's got the sort of runners ahead of him in someone like Aubameyang, and then he's got the other playmakers, Iwobi, Mkhitaryan, people he can play sort of, he can have neat, quick interchanges with. And then also, you know, second, and this was, I think, one of the key things that we saw, you know, someone else who can deliver sort of that kind of final ball. And obviously Alexis could do that, and did that on a number of occasions. But yesterday, you know, Arsenal scored 5 goals yesterday, and not a single one was directly assisted by Mesut Ozil. And usually that's not going to happen. Indeed, you know, the last time we had the Palace game, Ozil set up a goal, set up one of the 4, and he didn't set up any yesterday. So you can already sort of see the difference that bringing in Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang has made.
Yeah, I thought, to echo what Aiden said, I thought you've got this new side is clearly set up to complement Mesut Ozil. And I'm sure we'll talk about later how these signings probably had an effect of Ozil deciding to re-sign with Arsenal. But I mean, it's just one match, so it's hard to, I mean, you want to pump the brakes some a little bit, I guess, in terms of not getting ahead of ourselves.
You mean we're not going to win the league now?
Well, I think there's still a chance of that mathematically, right? I mean, if City lose every one of their matches and we win every one, I think mathematically that's still possible so far. But I mean, this is, it's hard not to get excited because you've got a striker who can create space for these three creative midfielders to work in behind, and Ozil, Mkhitaryan, and Iwobi. Each of those three are very strong, playing off of each other already, and finding the attacking space, or the space to best maximize the attack. And that also leads to space for Aaron Ramsey to run into to great effect on the day yesterday. But honestly, I say we should pump the brakes, but I was even more excited by the fact that I didn't think we were as sharp as we could be, especially in the second half. It seemed like it really showed that this was the first match these guys had really played together. When they started attacking with more verve at the beginning of the second half, we had a lot of really good opportunities to counter, and just kind of in weird situations, couldn't quite get the ball out of defense when the counterattack was on the table. So, I mean, it's, you can't help but be hopeful that not only did we have a match like this where we score 5 goals, but we kind of, we left a little bit on the table in terms of opportunities. And hopefully as they get more in sync and create more, that we can continue to consistently play exciting Arsenal attacking football, which, like we've mentioned, is something we haven't seen in the past few years. But there was, if there was one downside to this match, it made me really bummed that we didn't get Mkhitaryan 2 summers ago. It's just, I mean, he really does fit our style of play so well. He's got good pace, great positional awareness, good vision, ability to play that killer final ball. We didn't really even see any of his dribbling skills, but we know from his prior stints, particularly at Dortmund, that he has that in his locker. And particularly, I mean, I know our failings 2 seasons ago had a lot more to do with other things. And I think he moved to Manchester United the next summer. But anyways, it was disappointing that he couldn't have been brought in earlier, because he really does fit the style of play that we like to play.
There's something interesting about that. David Ornstein was on the Askcast on transfer deadline day. And, you know, obviously there were links, you know, Arsenal wanted Henrik Mkhitaryan 2 summers ago, the summer of 2016. But apparently, so the sort of the thing that happened was, A, Arsenal didn't, in the end, didn't move for Mkhitaryan as quickly as perhaps they should have. And then B, Manchester United got him. I think, you know, it's commonly thought that one reason Manchester United got him was to prevent Arsenal from getting him. But the reason why Arsenal kind of dallied over buying him is because he would have been, as he is now, a replacement for Alexis Sanchez. And in the end, Arsenal decided to keep Sanchez, and obviously he had a great season last year. I agree completely. Mkhitaryan looks like, the type of player that we have had in the past, the very direct, wide playmaker who is also, you know, who can also score goals. So, you know, you can think of the likes of Samir Nasri, Robert Pires. Obviously, Mkhitaryan's played 110 minutes or so for Arsenal. So, you know, yeah, let's pump the brakes on a bit. But it's that kind of style that we've known, that, you know, has been sort of lacking in recent seasons. And, you know, we've kind of talked a lot on this podcast about Arsene Wenger getting sort of the balance of his attacking lineup correct. And one reason that that's been difficult is he's not necessarily had that sort of wide playmaker type who can also chip in with goals. And, you know, obviously, you know, that's part of the remit of replacing, you know, part of the remit of replacing the goals that have left the club this window. 293, no, I think more than that. Anyway, so over, like, yeah, a lot of goals. Well, yeah, 293, I think, in this window with Walcott, Giroud, and Alexis.
You're forgetting Coquelin and his zero career Arsenal goals?
I'm forgetting. Oh, and Mathieu Debuchy and his, what, three goals? Two goals?
Sounds about right.
Yeah, yeah, big loss. But obviously, you know, part of that, the remit is to A, get more out of, is to get more out of Mesut Ozil sort of on the creative side, but also it's going to need to spread the goals around. Mkhitaryan's going to need to chip in with more. Aaron Ramsey is going to, you know, hopefully sort of, you can hope that he maybe gets 10 this season. He's on 6 now. He scored as many goals yesterday as the vastly improved Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain has all season. And then obviously there's Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. And I think that the other thing about Aubameyang that, and Drew, you mentioned the sort of counter-attacking thing, is he is genuinely, genuinely quick. I mean, really fast and, like, no shit, hashtag analysis, Aubameyang is fast. But, you know, you can really see the difference that it makes. For example, the chance that Aubameyang had before he scored when Ozil picked him out and he just streaked past the Everton defence. You know, we've not really seen that kind of, you know, with Theo Walcott out of the picture at Arsenal, we've not really seen that kind of run, that kind of ball, that kind of chance. Alexis, you know, is not as quick as Aubameyang and often didn't make that run. And, you know, Lacazette has really looked sluggish over the past few weeks. And so I think the genuine pace of Aubameyang is going to make a difference, I think, and really going to allow this team to sort of counterattack more.
The one thing that really stood out for me was, even though it was an offsides goal, that Mkhitaryan collected that pass and immediately turned, and you could see the two were completely in sync. Like, the first thing he did is he looked to see, okay, where's he running and how am I going to put this ball onto his feet? And Aubameyang made that run knowing that Mkhitaryan was going to be looking exactly at him. And that doesn't take anything away from Alexander Lacazette so much as it just shows that already, somehow, Aubameyang, within 90 minutes, appears to be just as much in sync with the team as Lacazette's shown all season to a certain extent. You know, there have been many games where Lacazette has made runs into space, but for one reason or another, potentially because he hasn't had a chance yet to play with guys like Mkhitaryan and Ozil on the regular basis, but it just hasn't clicked with them yet in terms of gelling with the rest of the side. And he's often been stranded on an island by himself and having very, very few chances. And we saw within the first 20 minutes yesterday, those two, just by themselves, are showing the others, this is how I play. This is how he plays. And it's just remarkable to see such a thing. And then to be able to your point, Aiden, his quickness, to have that right in the middle of the pitch. I mean, he's going to, I expect many, many goals where he just blows right past his marker like that, where there's no chance. I mean, his first two steps, it already looks like it's something that we haven't had since Henri, Theo when he was younger. So it's exciting. Pump the brakes, yes, but you could clearly see that the team has transformed and changed in a way that it's going to be exciting to see the run into the middle of May this year and how they play going forward.
Yeah, and one last thing on Mkhitaryan, almost as impressive as his three assists was his work rate yesterday. I think he was 4 out of 10 in tackles, 3 interceptions, and obviously 4 out of 10 isn't a hugely successful figure, but he was getting back and putting in the effort there a lot more than most wide players that we've had in recent years. And to me, even the lack of successful tackles, I think getting back is something that is important in and of itself, particularly considering how many how many goals we concede from quick attacking plays. I mean, we're most likely caught out in those situations. So someone getting back and even just slowing down the opposition's attack, it has a lot of value for us. And I was very impressed by his work right there on the right. I mean, I know I'm assuming that was why Mourinho relegated him to the bench, was some sort of disappointment on that front. But man, he put in a show yesterday on both sides of the pitch.
The one thing that I kind of found hilarious about that is I do think that Mkhitaryan's kind of gelled in real nicely. Obviously he had his 20 minutes at Swansea, his 90 yesterday, but conversely, because we are Arsenal fans, taking a look at the other side of the deal and seeing Jose Mourinho kind of slating Alexis Sanchez's ability to hold a team shape for his first match and chiding him after his very first match, saying that he ruined it essentially from at least a shape standpoint. Well, I mean, first of all, as an Arsenal fan, we've seen that now for 3.5 years, so it really wasn't news, but just, I don't know. It could be just the honeymoon phase of this deal, and I could certainly look at this 6-7 months later down the road and think otherwise, but I really think that we've made out with the better end of the deal thus far.
Yeah, one other thing about Mkhitaryan and also having Alex Iwobi in the side too, and is you know, you get all these playmakers into the side, and it sort of helps Arsenal in the sense of they're all very kind of good in their understanding on and off the ball, how to move, sort of, you know, how to find space, how to make space, and so that sort of helps Arsenal. And sort of helps the deficiencies that Arsenal have in attack, which I've written about before. I wrote about it a lot at the beginning of last season, just about Arsenal's sort of structure in attack and how that's there really isn't one. So having one way of alleviating that is by getting kind of all of these players onto the pitch and to an extent letting them play in some of Arsenal's best football, thinking about like the 07-08 side, you know, had all of these playmakers in it, Claire, Brzezinski, Fabregas, you know, even the Invincibles had, you know, Bergkamp, Pires, you know, Henri was definitely, you know, was a really creative player, Vieira, you know, did so many things. So, you know, I think that's sort of one useful thing. The other useful thing too is that for the first time in what seems like ages, Hector Bellerin had someone to sort of combine with down the right hand side, whether it be Mkhitaryan popping up there, whether it be Ozil, whether it be Alex Iwobi who sort of dropped into that space. And you know, really sort of used, one thing I was impressed by was sort of how Mkhitaryan used that space intelligently, whether he would, you know, he'd be on the right and be an option for Bellerin, then he would kind of drift inside. And that's something that Bellerin's just not had a lot this season. And he's so often been isolated. And it's, you know, obviously being isolated as a defender is not good. And, you know, whatever sort of, and whatever system Arsenal are playing, you know, there needs to be kind of cover ahead of Bellerin, because you can't be in a 2v1 every single time. But, you know, some of his struggles in attack this season have been down to the fact that he's just not had really, he's been completely isolated. It's a lot harder to, A, make decisive contributions when you are completely isolated from the rest of your sort of teammates. B, it's also a lot harder, you know, one thing that Bellerin has been good at in the past has been dribbling and using his pace. It's a lot harder to do that when, again, you're isolated. You know, defenses can double up on you. So, you know, hopefully that, in terms of improving Arsenal's team shape as a whole, hopefully sort of the addition of all of these playmakers into the team will do that.
Going from Hector to another player that's had a lot of criticism, probably more justly for his performances this year than Hector, who I think has been a little unfairly maligned. I want to give a little bit of a shout out to Granit Xhaka yesterday. Actually did not play like a jackass for the first time in a while. I know there was a little bit of concern when he was named as the deepest midfielder in our 4-2-3-1 that we played yesterday. But he was very solid back there. 3 out of 3 on tackles, 2 interceptions, 74 of 79 passing, which 3 of those were missed long balls. Getting this from the recently revitalized StatZone app, which...
Oh, for real? That's back up?
It's back up.
No kidding.
You can pay $2 to just have all of Arsenal stats, or I think you can pay more for more subscriptions or
Excellent.
Whatever. So it's back. So, and I mean, that's... It's the type of solid performance I thought he's capable of. I mentioned it on the last pod, I believe, that I thought he could fill that role, and I thought Wenger would probably give him at least the first shot to play there over Elneny. There's still, I think there's an argument to be made that maybe in home matches against lesser opposition, he's definitely the pick there. But I don't think it's necessarily nailed on that he gets that call on the road or against bigger teams. That remains to be seen, I think. But he was very good yesterday, and hopefully that is a jumping off point for him. I know it's been a rough week with the story about him having to disable Instagram comments because of all the abuse that he received on there, which is just terrible. So, I mean, it's just another part of social media. You can't control all of the jackasses that want to be jerks to people. I think Xhaka knows he was not performing up to the level that's required of him. And there's really no reason to be a jerk to somebody like that.
First of all, yes, I agree. I didn't realize that about StatZone, and I also didn't realize that about Xhaka's Instagram comments having to be disabled because of that. But that's quite unfortunate to hear that. The, you know, getting back to the actual play of Xhaka, he hasn't really been a massive defensive liability up until the last few months, where he's had some inexplicable brain farts, basically, where, you know, the run in where he completely let what's-his-face slide in, Klukas for Swansea City, slide in unmarked and right on Peter Cech, which, who could have also done a better job of defending, if we're all being honest about it. But the one thing I wonder about Xhaka is just, now it's the point where we've seen the bottom, now we've seen some of the best, and I just don't know which one's going to show up from week to week. And, you know, I think that it's obviously promising to see defensively his ability to be able to kind of hold that midfield down and be able to at least provide that support to our back line in a way that we kind of were questioning a few weeks ago. But, you know, it was against a pretty poor Everton side who didn't really have any sort of ability as far as attacking yesterday. Certainly not defending either. They were all around pretty shit. But the test is going to be on Saturday, clearly, when they play at Wembley. and it's I'm a little nervous still until I see him actually, you know, put a string of performances together that he's capable of playing in this role. And I know he did that at Borussia Mönchengladbach, so I know he has that ability. And I didn't think that necessarily the transition would be so prolonged, going from a similar position there to here and seeing some of the mistakes that's happened. But, you know, it's just going to have to be something we have to deal with until he figures it out on a consistent basis.
And one note before Aiden jumps in, but the reason why I thought he would get that first chance, and it showed yesterday, was his ability to get the ball to our best players and give it to them in a position to where they can do something with the ball. And again, via StatZone, Xhaka to Ozil was our number one passing combination yesterday, 17 times, I believe is what it was. Which when you're comparing that to Elneny and his kind of less progressive passing, I think that's a big key, is to have someone there that can get the ball to the main man as quickly as possible and to let him do something with it.
It's absolutely wonderful that StatZone is back. I'm going to continue to miss it because I do not have any Apple operated system. So expect a lot of texts from me asking for certain chalkboards and stuff. On the point about Xhaka, and this is not to excuse his quite frankly abysmal attempt at tracking runners, which has been a consistent issue this season. And there's been an issue in home games and away games, and more often away games because it's a lot more noticeable there, because there are often goals that end up deciding matches. I think, you know, when you look at the difference between the Xhaka of this season and the Xhaka of last season, at the end of last season, especially in the system that Arsenal played with three at the back, he's played higher up this season. And that, in a sense, is one of Mr. Wenger's very odd midfield kind of decisions that he makes. He likes pushing his midfielders up. He likes doing that because he thinks that's a way to sort of open up space and sort of get his midfield players between the lines, which is absolutely true. But on the other hand, that requires that everyone be everyone at the back be really good at playing out, and that everyone sort of higher up the pitch be able to receive the ball and turn and play very quickly, which, you know, some of the players can do, especially now that we've got someone like Mkhitaryan, and obviously Ozil has long been good at this. But what happens is that if you lose the ball, and if you lose the ball high up the pitch, then you're in a position where, you know, the midfield is very open, and all of a sudden you're running at the defense. And so kind of the second point of that is that I do think, and, you know, I think obviously Arsenal are much better at home than away from home. And I do think sort of one thing to try and get results from away games, and I know that they have often played the back three in away games to no avail. But if Arsenal are going to be that open, because the midfield is sort of pushed up by default, then I really think in away games you need to have three at the back just to have that extra cover. So, you know, talking about Spurs next week at Mr. Wenger's second stadium, I think sort of the key to that would be, and I know he's played a back four for most of the last five matches or so. Obviously, he switched to a back three during the second leg of the Chelsea game, second leg of the Chelsea Cup tie. I think a back three is probably the way to go in an away game, and that would sort of, you know, help. That would help Xhaka to an extent, because it would give, you know, not only does it give the defense extra cover, but it also means Xhaka, you know, if he does push higher up, there can be someone who pushes, you know, who sort can sort of push out behind him, which is something that worked really well when Arsenal beat Tottenham in November at the Emirates, and Shkodran Mustafi had a really good game, sort of pushing, sticking really tight on Harry Kane. So, you know, it was good to see it. And I agree completely with Drew about Xhaka's passing. It's, you know, it, and one reason why it was a lot better yesterday than it has been in recent weeks is A, Xhaka wasn't playing that weird box to box role, which he's not really suited for. He was playing a deeper role. He kind of had, you know, he had options. He had Aaron Ramsey, and then he had, you know, the three. He had Ozil, Iwobi, Mkhitaryan. I'd be interested to know how many passes Xhaka made to Aubameyang. I do think one thing that we could see develop in the near future is sort of Xhaka playing that longer ball, that longer switch of play for Aubameyang.
You know, I know that we'll end up talking back more about Xhaka, about Mkhitaryan, about Aubameyang, and so on and so forth here the next few minutes. But one thing I wanted to provide our listeners is, you know, this is our 14th episode that we've done, 13 more than I thought we would do. So as a gift to you, the one thing that Arsblog had on his podcast the other day was a very special guest. He had David Ornstein on, which was amazing because I was thinking to myself, man, it would be really cool if we could ever possibly interview David Ornstein ourselves. You know, he is by far probably the most hilarious follow, and it's completely unintentional because of all the memes that follow. And so I reached out to David Ornstein. We have a contact. It was a hard get, but we were able to secure David Ornstein. So he just got on the podcast. David, welcome to the show, man.
How you doing,
David? So I want to ask you: is your favorite meme the one where the four girls are tugging at you, or is it just the regular Ornstein or the Pornstein one?
So I've got a lot of love for the Breaking Bad ones.
Oh, the Breaking Bad ones. Yeah, yeah. Now, so when you explain to your parents your job and you have to also explain the people's reaction, do they sit and stare at you or do they actually get along with it and send you memes as well?
They started the memes off. It's been going on my whole life.
Oh, man. That's okay. That makes sense, I guess. Yeah, you know, I wish my parents would do the same, but unfortunately they're too ashamed of me. So, you know.
Was it just collages? Like, what? How did they?
It was all the popular culture of the day. As it came in.
Yes, yes. No, so...
There's a rich tapestry involved.
So as you do know, unfortunately, that is not David Ornstein. But welcome to the show, Michael Kashani. How you doing?
Sorry, I'm not so bad, thanks. Sorry I'm late.
Oh, you're fine. No, you're fine. It actually worked out perfectly because, you know, I wanted to be able to at least provide the listeners our own David Ornstein experience, and you did it very well. So it would have been awful had I tried the British accent. So thank you for that.
Perhaps what might have had a bit more comedy value within it.
Excellent. Well, and we're also recording at a time that's a little bit more normal compared to others. So thank you.
If anything, that's more likely to make me late, which is part of the problem.
But, oh, got it. Well, you know, I'll remember
well,
that.
Well, it's Super Bowl Sunday, so.
Exactly. So we were just talking about Granit Xhaka, as you heard. And do you have any quick thoughts as to his game yesterday?
At the moment I jumped in, Aiden was talking about being able to find use his longer passing to find Aubameyang. And obviously, as it was clarified, we didn't actually do it yesterday. But they made the game very easy for us. They sat quite deep. And so that's not the kind of pass we were looking for. And it's something that we can look to develop. I thought Xhaka was fine yesterday. Nothing of particular note in his performance. It's of all the things to pick out from yesterday's game, I think it's more something that we can look to in the future with regard to Xhaka. But he didn't stop tracking at any point. His passing was fine. There was one moment in the first half when he played it all the way back to the centre-backs, which kind of annoyed me because it was about half the length of the pitch at that stage. But apart from that, it was, for Xhaka himself, just pretty not particularly noteworthy performance, which I actually wanted to see more from him. So.
Yeah, and I think kind of to segue a little bit from what Aiden and Kesh said about the Spurs match, I think that will be something that we'll probably have to look for Saturday. I know the last time we played, we sat deeper and tried to play quick balls forward. And I think with Aubameyang, we've got the pace now to give them some trouble there. And I agree with what Aiden said about the three-man back line being possibly the best way to go here, especially if we can afford to take the goal-scoring Maestro, Nacho Monreal, and put him at center back again. I think that's, I know Wembley is our second home, but still our away form this season has been, abysmal. I think we kind of need to take a long look of what the issue has been there. And it's not all been tactical, like Aiden said. I mean, we played the three-man back line a lot on the road and sucked, and we played the four-man back line and sucked. We've had players healthy and injured and kind of just routinely been shit on the road this season. So I think a lot of that has to be not only tactics, but getting the players focused and having a game plan. And that Spurs, that first match we played against them this season was one of the more stark instances of where you really saw that we came into that match with a plan that deviated from what we generally try to do. It'll be interesting to see if we do that again. I would imagine Pochettino is somewhat expecting that. There might be a little bit of cat and mouse there. But yeah, certainly having the pace of Aubameyang up against their center backs, and particularly, I kind of wonder what the odds are on a Lloris red card this weekend, just because that's not that type of pace from a central striker isn't something that he typically has to go up with. That I would not mind at all him clattering into Aubameyang on a opening like the one that Ozil played yesterday for the Aubameyang chance. So I think it's set up to be a really interesting match. I think we've got a lot of really good counterattacking talent now. I think Aubameyang and Mkhitaryan are both improvements on that style of play from Lacazette or Alexis. I think Alexis was always not quite as good at that as we would have liked to think, and he certainly showed that yesterday. He killed quite a few counterattacks, but he got his goal. So anyways, I'm looking forward to the match Saturday, but it will be interesting to see how we set up because this is the first really big test since our new signings have joined.
On the point that we were terrible when we played three at the back away from home earlier in the season as well, we were obviously 4-3-4 regardless. But looking back at those fixtures at the moment, so you've got an example like Stoke, where we were the better team, we should have had penalties, but our substitutions were horrible and the selections within the actual three were horrible. Liverpool, the same thing, but we were a total disgrace. Chelsea was quite a good game, as in quite a good performance from us, especially considering we didn't have Alexis starting. I think we didn't have Ozil at all. And you take the example of Watford, where we at 1-1, for some reason, he decided to keep three at the back rather than go for it, and it just invited all the pressure onto us. Everton, we won. And obviously City's kind of a write-off. Burnley, we won. And it's not to say that three at the back is necessarily the answer to our horrible away performances, but there's more that can be said that within the system, we've made mistakes that the system didn't make for us, if that makes sense. So our last away game over in Swansea, we were a swinging door at the back. But then you use the example of Bournemouth, where we did play the back three. We weren't exactly too open. We just folded in on ourselves. But that all being said, particularly with the bigger games, I think three at the back is definitely the way to go. And it's more about the mistakes we've made within the system than the fact that the system has undone us, as I think the four did at Swansea.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you mentioned the away games at Stoke, where for some bizarre reason, Hector Bellerin was played at left wing back and Oxlade-Chamberlain was played at right wing back.
With Kolasinac at centre back, who then got subbed off for Giroud.
Yes. and then I seem to recall like Lacazette scoring a goal which was wrongly given offside, and then like 5 minutes later he took Lacazette off for Walcott, which was odd given that Giroud and Lacazette.
Tremendous nonsense.
Yes. The substitutions this season have at times been really bizarre. Yeah, I mean, I think you know, you look at the Watford game was bad, but we did invite sort of the pressure on when we should have pushed on at 1-1. Bournemouth, I think, you know, there was a lot sort of going on on and off the pitch that I think made not necessarily inevitable that Arsenal would fold under pressure, but you know, there were a lot of absences. Obviously Alexis was sort of on the verge of leaving. Mesut Ozil was out injured. Aaron Ramsey was just coming back from injury. So I think there's a lot of sort of like disruption in the team. And I think that sort of made, you know, when you were looking for, you know, at sort of 1-0, sort of that kind of more senior adult player to kind of take charge in the midfield and sort of calm things down, there just wasn't anyone there to do that. So, you know, I think that plays a role.
Or in the same vein, you're extremely decorated goalkeeper not throwing the ball in his own net.
Well, yes, that too. Yes, the one adult in the actual side did that. Those are our last two away games, aren't they, in the league? That he's just thrown one. He's just either thrown one or kicked one in.
I don't know if we'll ever. I mean, I know that Ospina did that. That one time, but I remember my reaction was to throw the remote and laugh at the same time when Cech, and I know that he was kind of put in that position on that back pass. It was a very, very bad circumstance to be in his regard, but or in his place. But holy shit, like that's something I can fucking do, right? With my left foot, like that was awful. And I don't buy the rain. I don't buy the pitch. It was one of the dumbest mistakes I've seen by a keeper from us in a very long time.
All right, Aiden, you want to start the Ramsey love fest?
Sure. Obviously, scored the hat trick. But I think what was sort of notable about his game yesterday was that he scored a hat trick. Without necessarily breaking forward every single time, which has been, you know, I think an unfair criticism of him in the past, but rather you can kind of see how he works, how he's already kind of developing a relationship with Mkhitaryan and building on the relationship he already has with you know, Ozil, and sort of how, you know, he really kind of chose his moments to break into space and be that kind of extra runner. And you can see him dovetailing well with the kind of playmakers ahead of him. And especially because all of them are very comfortable kind of dropping into a deeper position. But you know, one thing that Ramsey did a lot, and I think that sort of helped him, you know, make Xhaka's game, more error free is that Ramsey kind of was deep a lot and sort of, you know, had helped kind of build Arsenal's play. He had like 57 passes, 91% completion on those passes. And so, you know, we were talking about kind of a midfield structure, and I think you sort of saw yesterday kind of a more structured midfield, especially in the first half. Obviously, second half was a bit different, but sort of understandably so. Like, you know, you're 4-0 up. You don't need to play with the same intensity. Especially because Everton were terrible.
No, I'd agree overall. The first and third goals more than the second, obviously, but they were very good. No moments where he timed his runs very well. And like Aiden said, he stayed pretty restricted through the game. It was one of the more reserved performances we've seen from him at home against a rubbish team. And that much is in itself encouraging. It means that with a runner at centre forward, we're less reliant on the runs that he gives us anyway, which means that we can use them as we should, which is as a supplement to the attacks we're building. And even the example of the second goal, he was 20 yards from goal and we were trying to get the ball into the box, which is where, like, not necessarily where you want him to be all the time, but you want him to not necessarily be playing as some kind of second centre forward, which we've had him doing with his runs at times. And not to say that he's abandoned the defence, because again, I also think that's a very unfair criticism that's levelled at him. But a lot of the time, I think particularly in 15-16, where our tactics kind of disintegrated, where they hadn't exactly been particularly strong before, but our whole plan appeared to be get the ball wide, get Ramsey in high up in the middle, get Giroud there with him, and just put the ball in the box and hope for the best. And obviously that never really succeeded. And yeah, as I said, with Aubameyang as that presence rather than Lacazette, who I do like, but it changes the way we play. and it means that we can have him more as an extended outlet rather than his runs being central to the way we have to try and build attacks.
Yeah, I think that's pretty important. I mean, he is a good all-around midfielder, and I think it kind of suits him more, as you said, to be a supplement to attack and not the main cog, or one of the two main cogs, I guess. And he does, I mean, he can just cover so much ground. He was deep. I mean, he was getting back and defending deep at times. I think that's really important to use that aspect of his game as well. Like Aiden said, he was very good passing the ball yesterday, had a good passing completion percentage. And he just gives us such a good all-around threat from midfield, because he can do a little bit of everything. That's always been his strength. So it was an encouraging performance. And I think also encouraging Jack not being a total disaster recently, because I think both of those guys are better when they're not being played every week. They both suffered these long injury stints, and have not shown the ability to stay fit for 40 matches a year. So I think it'll be key from here on out, to, you know, be able to give Ramsey breaks. I think he clearly, at least at the moment, is the superior option of the two, but that the fact that Jack could come in there and spell him, I think, is a big, big plus for us. Cause Ramsey just, I mean, he can't stay healthy, and he's so good when he's fit. And I think that would be a great benefit to us if he can stay fit for the rest of the season.
And just on the point about sort of supplement runs, for all three goals, and obviously the second one was a longer shot that was deflected, but for all three goals, Ramsey's basically unmarked. And part of that is Everton being terrible. But that's also, you know, another aspect of that is, A, it's really hard to track those sort of runs when they're timed really well, which he does so well. And secondly, when you've got someone who's got such good penalty, such good movement in the penalty box, like Aubameyang, you know, he attracts defenders, because obviously, you know, you're going to mark the opposition striker. And it opens up space for someone like Ramsey to take on that sort of late run. So, you know, I think, hopefully, I think I said this earlier, but, you know, one aspect of sort of replacing the output that Alexis Sanchez had is by having Ramsey score more goals. And he's got 6 for the season now, so 10 is not an unrealistic target. And, you know, that would be the third season out of 5 that he would have hit double digits. So that's sort of a mark of consistency. So, you know, all around it's good signs.
Yeah, and I think it's important. I mean, maybe not Ozil level, but it's important to see if we can get an extension worked out with him before the end of the season. I know he would have one season after this, so he would be out of contract in May of 2019. It's kind of hard to envision us keeping him around like Alexis or Ozil this past year if he doesn't sign. And really, he's just such a fun player to watch. I really hope that we can come to some sort of middle ground between where he's at and where our position is. But it's so clear that Wenger rates him, and he has since he brought him on at a very young age. I think he doesn't have to worry about playing time here. He'll get played as much as he wants. When he's healthy, Wenger has started him. Whether it's, I mean, he's kind of shoehorned him in different positions from time to time, but he clearly rates him and the effect he has on the team. But it's, I mean, this is one of those tough negotiating points. It's kind of what we mentioned with Jack. How much money do you commit to a guy that has his injury history? So I really hope there is some middle ground. I think we've got plenty of space in our wage bill to do something this season. I know I've written about this issue a lot on the shortfuse.com about the Premier League wage bill cost control restrictions. And one of the things I mentioned from the very beginning was this is a very It's a very soft cap rule to kind of borrow from the American sports lexicon. So with the space we've created this year from getting these contracts off the books, with increasing our revenue with these player sales, there's a lot of space that we could use to give Ramsey a front loaded deal, give him a signing on bonus. It would be beneficial to us to use up our cap space this season, so to say, to give us more room to bring in players over the summer or going forward, just to kind of artificially boost the wage bill this season, because for those who don't know, that rule is pegged to your prior year contracts. So the more we pay our players this year, the more room we have to operate next year, because we have you can read more elsewhere, but yeah. So I think if we could do something creative to pay him up front a decent signing on fee, and then maybe work out a more performance-based contract, I think that should be something that we're really pushing to get done here in the next couple months.
Well, which that's a good transition to something else that happened on deadline day that I want to make sure we cover real quickly before we leave, is the extension of Mesut Ozil, which coincided directly after the announcement of Aubameyang's transfer in. So we had brought in Mkhitaryan, we brought in Aubameyang. We were in the process this past month of clearing out a lot of space to kind of reshape the team, and it seemed like that final piece of the puzzle was getting that contract extension that we've been looking for the past 16, 18 months. And the significance of it, I don't think really should ever be forgotten about, because as Aiden mentioned earlier in the podcast, you can see that this is a team that is being slowly built around Mesut Ozil. So to be able to have his commitment in for the next 3.5 years, and, you know, if he's still playing at a high level, then maybe even more than that. But to be able to really kind of cement this being Mesut Ozil's team, and to be able to ensure that going forward, we're able to slide in the pieces according to how they kind of would interact and play with Mesut Ozil on the pitch is a huge thing. And possibly, I would say, going almost as far as to say that that's probably the best thing that we did in the month of January.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you heard, but I'm pretty skeptical of Arsenal's transfer business the past couple of days. That wasn't me. That was someone else related to SB Nation.
Yeah, no, it was a shit ton of bad business, and we should never forget that.
Like you said, I mean, signing Ozil was a huge statement. We gave him huge wages. I think it was important. It was only 3.5 years. I think that's pretty big too. I think that's a pretty relatively low downside for a player of his type. I think he will still be just about as effective then as he is now, which is a big deal when you're talking about big contracts for players. That was something I was pretty worried about with Alexis. I mean, if we had given him a 3 or 4 year extension, there's some real concerns that his style of play would not hold up as he ages. But I think that was a huge deal, and I think it was clearly kind of like we've mentioned today and in past podcasts. I think the Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang signings were big points to get him to sign on. Because I mean, I know we all kind of I know it was a popular viewpoint to just kind of blow it up and sign young players and let's just do that. But I think soccer is not quite the same as other American sports where you can blow it up and that might be the best way to rebuild. I think you can have a two-track rebuilding phase where you stay relevant and in contention, which I think those signings did, and still bring in younger players to supplement, because that's basically what Manchester City have done to great effect the last few years. So I think it was huge for us. It was crucial. There was really no way we could feasibly replace him in the summer. Like you said, that was just about as big a news, if not the biggest news of deadline day.
Yeah, well, for me, the one thing that you were just mentioning that it rings a huge bell for me is I'm a you know, going to a different sport, but I'm a massive Minnesota Timberwolves fan. And, you know, for the longest time, they've been infused with young talent that's never really been put together. And there is something to be said about being able to have very talented veterans, very talented players who've been around the league or been around the club or been around top-level competition. And, you know, having a guy like Jimmy Butler come in for the Timberwolves has really transformed them. But there is something to be said about a very, very young team not being able to have that guidance and direction. And this is an excuse to say, oh, well, I'm not going to sit and listen to people complain about Arsenal's business because they brought in a bunch of old guys, talented but older guys. It's just a way for I think, the general scope of why those moves are made and be able to transition what was the roster pre-January into what it's going to be going forward, especially with the new guys that Gazidis has brought on. So that's the way I kind of look at it from that regard. So one last thing before we leave here. You know, there was one other move that happened on deadline day, one that really kind of shook Arsenal fandom to the core. Well, certain people. There are others who are surprisingly happy with the move, and I will never understand it why. But Olivier Giroud did move from Arsenal to Chelsea, went across the city, and was promptly the very next day photographed on Chelsea's bench laughing, which was very, very funny to me in the face of a 3-0 defeat to Bournemouth. But I want to be able to give the floor here to Aiden and Kesh and be able to let them kind of express their love for their dad, who is now gone and passed on and over in Chelsea. I just want to let them just kind of talk for a few minutes about their guy.
I've got a Chelsea mate who is the Giroud has been the subject of a number of our conversations, and I've never quite been able to explain to him why I have such love for Giroud. Because to him, he doesn't watch Arsenal that much, but he sees a functional, effective backup centre forward who can come off the bench, provide an awful lot. He's got certain qualities, he lacks certain other qualities. All in all, a good player to have in a squad, a good player to have in a team. But why is he special? And I feel that you have to see him up close in order to understand it. And how it feels is a very emotional thing that I wouldn't be able to watch him knee slide at the Emirates ever again. It'll be knee sliding in heaven now, but there's it's difficult because Giroud is on the one hand is very functional, is very useful, very sort of utilitarian player, if you will. But that's not the soul of Giroud. The essence of him is someone who, just almost despite themselves, he's too charismatic not to see centre stage all the time. He can't stop himself being the man who everyone looks to. Whether it was part of his plan or not, he seems to want to just go out there and help the team. And yet here he is, seizing the hearts and minds of the people purely just by doing his job, because everything draws towards him. And on a more similarly more sincere note, it's difficult to reconcile the idea I have of Giroud now as this all-conquering Adonis who loves being on film with the guy who we signed, because it was so clear to see how the pressure would get to him of playing for the Arsenal and having to replace Van Persie, and how he would struggle with teams that weren't suited to him. And it was all understandable, especially considering this was a guy we signed for 12 million from the French league. But and the fact that the way that he's changed, it sort of reflects on why he's become so popular and why he'll be so missed, is because he did have bad times, and he had a lot of moments where you did kind of just want to kill him. And to override those is to sort of ignore them, is to just sort of miss the essence of Giroud, because the fact that he became someone who we could rely on in big games, after big games were typically his struggle point in his early days, and someone who we could just rely on to come and help us when everyone else had given up, is because he didn't give up on anything. The fact that he was playing, I think, in the third league in France when he was 22 years old, and now he plays for the Premier League champions. There is this unwavering self-belief within Giroud. And it shows from everything, to how handsome he is, to his charisma, to his playing style. The fact that he was always the person who would show up late, because he didn't let himself get himself down. And when he was playing badly, you could see it getting to him. And yet, to take the Monaco game, for example, he followed that up by scoring 7 goals in the next 7 games. And he just, he had this unwavering self-belief that allowed him to become something that he never really looked like he could ever be when he first got here. And that's an important thing for us to have within a team and within a squad, especially as someone, whose role was often coming off the bench in the later days. But then on a more sort of general note overall, that, that kind of personality, that entertainment, the fact that he could score goals by accident, he could score a scorpion kick and then score with his face. It's, there's the thing about Giroud is everything about him is in contrast to itself. He is, he's functional. He's also useless. He's a showman who's actually just very down to earth and hardworking. And he's a family man who goes shagging about. He is everything and nothing. And to try and define Giroud is almost to fail him. And there was a real charm about him and the way he played. And I'm really going to miss him, even if I accept that it was probably time for him to move on. I mean, it was almost definitely time for him to move on. He needed the game time. We need to free up the space in the squad. I still think he could have served a purpose for the end of the season, particularly with the Europa League. But it was time. And the fact that I can't even be annoyed at anyone apart from God just makes it all the more difficult. But yeah, like I said, I understand every detail. I don't necessarily disagree, but I'm very much going to miss him.
That's an extremely hard eulogy to follow up. So I think what I'll limit it to is Olivier Giroud, the character in contrast and with the footballer was just fun, and at its essence, you know, football is supposed to be fun. And you know, the thing that I think sums up Giroud for me, and this sort of everything that Michael talked about, like his self-belief, his you know, willingness to his hard work, his willingness to carry on, and then just the showmanship of Giroud is the Champions League in 2015-16, when he got sent off in the first match that we played, followed that up by scoring a handball winner against Bayern Munich, and then scored the hat-trick that saw us through to the round of 16 in the last game, including that second goal where it looked moments before that he had just like really done something bad to his ankle, and he just stepped up and ran on to like a through ball from I think Joel Campbell. So I think in that sort of run you saw everything about Giroud that made Giroud who he is, and I'm going to miss him, and I'm going to miss his exceptional celebrations.
There's just one celebration I want to talk about quickly. There's obviously, we know for the knee slides, I've posted that on Twitter a little while ago, but we know for the knee slides, the over the top, just some nonsense, the scorpion kick celebration. The one I love possibly the most is the one at Old Trafford. It's when he equalised and made it 1-1, and yet all he did was just stand up and point to heaven. And it was such a phenomenal subversion of his own genre. He scored a last minute equaliser at one of the biggest stages in world football. You'd think he'd go mad. I mean, the rest of the team were. Giroud, no. Giroud just decided he was going to play it completely straight back and make the arena show respect to him rather than vice versa. And it's that kind of showmanship out of nowhere that you just can't teach. You can't learn it. You can't fathom it. And I'll never quite understand Giroud, but I don't think I ever want to. And I still hold your hand in mine when I'm asleep. And I will build my soul in time when I'm kneeling at your feet. Goodbye, my lover. Goodbye, my friend. You have been the one. You have been the one for me. Goodbye, my lover. Goodbye, my friend.
friend. You have been the one. You have been the one for me. I'm so hollow, baby. I'm so hollow. I'm so, I'm so hollow.